Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. And today I'm here with Judith May Fatala, who is the author of Killer Fandom, Fan Studies, and The Celebrity Serial Killer. Judith, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Could you start by talking a little bit about how this book came to be, how you got interested in serial killer fandom and fan culture?
Sure. I am probably best known as a fan studies scholar nowadays. I do some work on open access publishing as well, but I think that as a researcher, fan studies has been one of my primary interests. And my first two books were rather more traditional, I suppose, in terms of fan studies. My first book was on fan fiction. My second book was on music subcultures, specifically emotional hardcore or emo. And I am a true crime enthusiast. Notice how kind of carefully I phrase that there. I have always been sort of in my non-academic life, somebody who consumes a lot of content related to true crime, a lot of podcasts, a lot of television shows, books, etc. And through that, I sort of became aware, if you like, of the more taboo or the more niche or the more pathologized area of serial killer fandom. Is in the sense I was vaguely aware they existed, but I think if people think about it, most people are aware of the existence of serial killer fans. If they sort of as I mentioned in the book, there's been a fairly steady stream of weird news stories more or less pointing out in more or less pathologizing ways the various fans that serial killers have had, or celebrity serial killers. And those interests then sort of came together and collided in that I started to wonder, well, fan studies now is fairly well-established field. We have sort of fairly set and accepted ways and frames of looking at fandom, and I wondered in what ways would the frames that we use typically in fan studies be useful to apply to this more taboo or more, I guess, more secretive, perhaps more anonymous form of fandom, and what ways it wouldn't be. And I looked around a little bit and I saw a few academics beginning to look at quote-unquote dark fandoms, and I don't like this term because I think it's a racist pedigree, and we shouldn't use the term dark when we mean sinister or we mean taboo or we mean pathologized or whatever. So I just tend to call it what it is. Call it serial killer fandom, call it school shooter fandom. Just use the term of what you're talking about rather than trying to put it under this heading of quote unquote dark fandom.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I have recently talked to someone who wrote a book or has written a series of books on dark tourism. And so I found that especially interesting in thinking about, like, how do we label, because that sort of this all encompassing. And if you visit, and then a lot of this book at least was on much of it visiting Holocaust memorial sites, right? And so then, like, there are specific sort of niche spaces that you could talk about as opposed to labeling everything dark, right?
I think that that's where it came from. I think how it's come into fan studies is crossing over from tourism and heritage studies, because as you say, there is this sort of subfield of quote unquote dark tourism. And I think that fan tourism is a subfield, and people just kind of picked up the terminology in a kind of uncritical way. And I'm including my past self in that. Even despite the fact that I'm a person of color, I'm as inculcated in the racist pedigrees of the English language as anyone else, so it was really when I did a different interview with a radio show on a network called BTRN that the host kind of opened that conversation with me, for which I'm very grateful, and I like acknowledge that in the book.
So we have this serial killer fandom that, and it was interesting. I had a class yesterday with a few students, and the book was sitting on my desk, and so one of them said, "People actually like follow serial killer. They do this." And another one was like, "Yes, they do. They do. It's a whole thing." For people who, I think there's people who know and know and see this out there. I think there's people who know there are kind of fans of serial killer, but you really talk about it being a culture, fan culture, right? So can you kind of talk and ground us in that, and sort of when you're thinking about this, what you sort of see and sort of how you position these folks that you looked at.
Well, I think that fandom is a difficult term, and I argue in some ways that I think that in fan studies we overuse the term community. I think we sometimes stretch community too far as a theoretical term, and I argue in chapter three that there is some notion of a serial killer fandom, and that there is some sort of positive boundaries to it, but it's community in a weak sense. And that is really to do with the relative anonymity of the space, the very rapid turnover of Tumblrs and TikToks and materials, which are frequently banned or get taken down and reappear. It's very pseudonymous or anonymous. It's very unstable. So I think we need to be like a little bit careful of the term fandom as denoting a group or a community. Although there is some kind of exchange of affect and bonding in the ways that we see in more traditional online communities. But I thought that that was probably the theoretical perspective that was least usefully applied from what has been done in fan studies already. So I kind of, look at things like textual poaching, look at subcultural capital building, look at digital play. And then there's this chapter on a serial killer fan community. And I think that was the weakest frame to apply to it, and digital play was the strongest. So yeah, does that answer the question, or yeah?
Right. And as you're talking, one of the things I thought was interesting in the book and thinking about your methodology and doing this work is that there's one point at least you always said, this could disappear. I have to take a photo of it, right? Because of the sources of media. So can you talk a little bit about that and the research and kind of how you research this and how kind of ephemeral you some of the data becomes because of just where it exists and how you're trying to find it and the social media and how that plays out.
Well, I used the Wayback Machine and the Internet Archive a lot to archive as I was studying. I think the Internet Archive is a hugely important resource and one that is worth fighting for. That kind of goes into my other area of interest, which is open access publishing. And For example, possibly the strongest demonstrator of community that I did find was a subreddit called Hybristophilia. Hybristophilia was not a term I'd come across before, but apparently it is a recognized, I guess, psychopathology, which means attraction to violence or attraction to the potential of violence. And as I stored a lot of that data in the Internet Archive, I stored a lot in my own, in OneDrive of my university, which is password protected, etc. And as soon as I finished the data collection, that community was banned and purged. So I was really lucky. But that's just one example. Another example would be the Tumblrs that I explore either get banned or they get taken down because they're being targeted by what fans refer to as antis. In other words, people who, quite interestingly, often set their own true crime consumption up as normal and target people whose consumption of true crime they consider to be pathological, which, as I argue throughout the book, is not such a, an easy binary to draw, and it's more like really a spectrum than a binary. And I'm not sure that, any consumption or production of true crime as a media product can make a claim to some kind of epistemological innocence here. We're all implicated in this. Fans, as I say in chapter one, fans didn't make serial killers into celebrities. We all did that. The media industries did that. The public did that from going back to the invention of Jack the Ripper, so that's one reason that the resources go down is because they receive, as they call it, hate or targeting by antis. But then what would typically happen is the Tumblr would go down and then it would pop up again with like X1 on the end of the name or just a variation. So I did a lot of locating of material on TikTok and Tumblr by searching tags and searching search terms, which was much, I mean, it's not reliable because the Tumblr search function isn't reliable, but it was more useful than trying to follow certain blogs on my dashboard because they kept disappearing or they went down or whatever.
Right. And so, and you mentioned as you answered that you kind of looked at your first chapter looks at sort of engagement before fan studies, right? So, can you talk a little bit about that? How I really, I, you know, and I've always heard that, but I really appreciated how you talked about sort of the engagement with serial killers, with Holmes and with Jack the Ripper, and how people kind of were infatuated or were part of that sort of serial killer interest in serial killers much earlier than we think of the sort
Sure.
of modern day ones.
So I personally found this really interesting when I started looking at it. So I think that our conception, the term serial killer dates probably to the 1970s, but I think that our conception of a serial killer in the Western world generally is dated to the invention, the construction of the figure of Jack the Ripper. And I think what's important to understand is that Jack the Ripper is an invention of what I call proto-convergence. So we're used to the idea of media convergence in the contemporary media sphere. And Jack the Ripper is an invention of the newly literate tabloid consuming Victorian public and penny press. So obviously this was the time at which cheap penny newspapers were becoming popular, where more people were able to read at a basic standard and more people were able to access newspapers cheaply. And also, the birth of what is called, sometimes referred to as new journalism, which we associate with a tabloid style of reporting. So the public appetite for sensational news was very high. And newspapers pretty much invented Jack the Ripper. I think I should say here, the police, I'm not, that Jack the Ripper and the Whitechapel murderer are not the same thing. So the person who actually carried out these murders at Whitechapel was known to the police fairly early on to be the Polish barber, Aaron Kaminski, as has now been more or less confirmed by DNA sampling. This was, you know, if you go through the police records, you can see that they had a reliable witness, but, you know, he was schizophrenic. He was already institutionalized, and the witness didn't want to testify because they didn't want the execution of an insane person on their conscience. The invention of Jack the Ripper as this figure onto which Victorian fears of otherness, of foreigners, of barbarity, of the of medicine, of, you know, there's this one theory that it's a mad doctor, of medicine being out of control, of science being out of control. This is a whole other thing. And the public collaborated with great fever in this via, for example, letter writing. The name Jack the Ripper is from a postcard that somebody sent to one of the newspapers claiming to be the killer. And there were loads of these postcards. Jack the Ripper is just the most famous one. It's not real, by the way. None of them are authentic, almost certainly. But people writing into the papers claiming to be the killer, claiming to know the killer, describing in great detail what they would do next. Personators, I found this so interesting. People describing in their diary how they would dress up and pretend to be the killer. Almost, is it cosplay? It sounds like cosplay. So I think that this sort of public, of what I call media proto-convergence is how we invent the myth of Jack the Ripper. And also, I mean, H.H. Holmes was a real person. And so it's sort of to a lesser degree, I guess. But he, for example, very much catered to the public appetite for the legends of his own monstrosity, and seemed probably greatly exaggerated the number of people he actually killed and the amount of booby traps and so on that were in his quote unquote murder mansion. And then I move on to sort of the 20th century, when we get into moral panics around serial killers as sex symbols. So I think a lot of people know the story of the girls turning up to the trials of Ted Bundy dressed in ways that look like the profile of his victims. But I think the interesting thing about this is that was the first publicly televised trial. And I look at the way that the 20th century media kind of celebritizes different serial killers and pretends and assumes a pose of moral authority and neutrality whilst very much contributing to and constructing them as celebrities, which goes on to this day, as in, you know, alive and well on Netflix right now. Go stream, you know, you can stream it right now.
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting because I have a new teenager, right? A 13-year-old. And like that middle grades here in the United States seems to be the time when the serial killer and the Ted, I remember, like, was it a year or so ago where the Ted Bundy show came out? And that becomes this time where there's this obsession with like these serial killers and what is this like? And you mention, and so the next chapter you talk about sort of textual poachers, and in that you mentioned the My Friend Dahmer, the graphic novel, right? These are sort of accessible to a younger audience. So it continues to become something you can more easily access or sort of take in and become part of that culture. So can you talk a little bit about that too? That kind of you talk a little bit about Jenkins textual poaching and how, even though that idea has changed, do you still see some importance in it, especially in these online cultures? So what you're doing in that chapter and sort of how that plays out.
Yeah, so textual poaching, that was the phrase that Henry Jenkins made famous, for the techniques by which fans of a media product will adapt narratives or material to write their own stories or make their own fan art or write their own songs, of copyrighted media products, which at the time he was writing, tended to be more underground and more secretive. And now it's sort of media properties bank on it. And he has largely disavowed the metaphor of textual poaching and saying that, you know, seeing fans as sort of these relatively powerless, relatively secretive activities, it doesn't make sense anymore in this kind of landscape of media convergence where, you know, massive franchises depend on and incorporate and court fan activity and so on. And what I thought was interesting is that in some ways, the fanish material around serial killer media kind of fits better into the older model of textual poaching than into a newer model of convergence culture. And the main reason for that, I think, is that it's not economically, you can't incorporate it economically. You can't sell it back to the audience, in the way that you can say Game of Thrones fan art, for example. HBO, for example, commissioned a book of fan art, which then the art fan artist has handed over the copyright. HBO sells the fan art back to the audience. So that's a good example of incorporation of fan activities. And I don't think really it's that surprising that there's fan fiction about serial killers or there's fan art about serial killers because there's so much media about them, then why wouldn't there be? There's probably fan fiction about everything. And particularly, as you say, when we have these accessible texts like My Friend Dharma, which I guess is a kind of fan fiction in a way, people then adapt and make their own text from it, which in some ways poaches and inverts and repurposes the themes and storylines and so on of the mainstream media, and then in other ways consolidates what's already there. And I think it, in some ways, because it is more underground, because it is more secretive, because it does exist in this relatively closed sphere, because it can't be reincorporated, and because fans use it to their own purposes, in some ways fits better into this older lens of textual poaching than it does newer ideas about convergence culture. And of course, that kind of makes sense when you think that fandom as a whole used to be pathologized in the way that only certain kinds of fandom are now.
Right, so you sort of look at that and talk about that and look at sort of how fans are creating fan fiction, fan art, and then also kind of how people are reacting to some of that, which and you mentioned this earlier, but I thought was really interesting to think about that it is not this the ways in which people there are some things that are acceptable, there are some things that are not acceptable, and that line moves often, right? In sort of this sort of fan space. And so throughout, I thought that was really interesting. And one of the things that you mentioned that I wanted to ask you about or have you talk about a little, because I think it's important, is you talk about how as queerness often in fandoms, especially in fan fiction, is something that is acknowledged and accepted. But with Jeffrey Dahmer, that's become something that people kind of often ignore, right? And so, can you talk a little, because I thought that was really interesting, and something to that I never really like thought about when I was thinking about this. Could you talk a little bit more about what you were seeing with how people were talking about Dahmer in ways that were sort of ignoring and erasing his queerness?
So that was a peculiar finding. We often imagine that fan culture queers popular media and sort of rights in queer relations and characters where we find them absent or lacking or insufficient in the source text. First of all, I should say a word on the media construction of Jeffrey Dahmer as opposed to, say, Ted Bundy. So, Jeffrey Dahmer is generally constructed in the popular media as a monster with, well, yeah, that's what the Netflix series is called, isn't it? It's called Monster, with all the historical baggage related to queerness of the monstrosity metaphor. So he is both a victim and a villain. He's a tragic monster, sort of this Jekyll and Hyde struggling to control this inner beast. And this sort of ties into broader narratives of queerness as monstrous, as tragic, as doomed, etc. Whereas if you look at sort of the I mean, I think another academic whose name escapes me right now put it very well when he said that Ted Bundy, a heterosexual man who killed women, had to be constructed by the press as an aberration. Which, arguably he's not. He's the peak of a patriarchal structure that results in the death of women every day. So he's constructed as an aberration, an absolute, the opposite of what everybody expected to happen. But Dharma is constructed almost as like the fulfillment of what we would expect of the tragic, monstrous queer, okay? And in fan fiction and fan art, people just tend to kind of gloss over and elide his queerness and either like write him into a redemptive heterosexual relationship wherein he sort of is able to suppress the inner, is it Jekyll or Hyde? That's the bad one. I
Oh,
forgot.
yes. Hyde, right, Hyde,
Yeah,
right, Dr.
able
Jekyll.
to suppress the inner Hyde, or just sort of ignore it. And I thought, so are we using like heterosexuality as a kind of corrective, to this narrative of monstrosity, which is almost the inverse of what people think that fandom has historically done. Which is like to write in narratives of legitimating narratives of queerness where they haven't existed. So that was a really striking finding. As to why that is, I think it shows the enduring power of the queerness monstrosity connection, even at a subconscious level. For a lot of people in a lot of popular culture. I said in the chapter that one of the categories, I assigned the stories that I found to categories, and I called one of them fix-its, these kind of redemption arcs. And pretty much all of the redemption arcs were about like were heterosexual love stories.
Yes, if you just fell in love, you'd be fine.
Well, fan fiction doesn't operate in a vacuum, it's the redemption of heterosexual love is such a powerful cultural narrative that it seems to inflect this discourse very strongly.
So So we have this, your next chapter talks about like, and you brought this up before, looks at affect bonding and boundaries. And you have this question of, is there really a serial killer fan community and what that means? So can you talk a little bit then about like how you are looking at whether or not there is a community and what sort of what is going on in these spaces?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I think that we can sometimes stretch the term community too far in fan studies. Can we really kind of call people with a shared interest who have no real connection with each other than are like members of the same community? I'm not sure, but there are aspects that academics recognizes fundamental to the fan community, such as gift culture or circular giving, wherein people create texts, create videos, create art without the expectation of an immediate return, due to the understanding that creating gifts for the community generally enriches a community and results in one receiving more gifts in general than one puts effort into. So a kind of contribution to a commons, if you like. And I did see some elements of gift culture. I did see some evidence of bonding, particularly on Reddit, where users tend to have more stable identities than they may, for example, on TikTok or Tumblr. Although, as I say, that Reddit community got banned. I saw some evidence of role play, which, some people think of as evidence of a community. But I think that what's quite important is that a lot of people think that for a community to be called a community, it has to recognize itself as a community and have some conception of an out-group and an in-group, some conception of those who are like us and those who are not like us. And the fact that serial killer fans are pathologized and othered by people who consider their interest in true crime to be normal and respectable, in many ways, reinforces this sense of a community. And actually, they fans comment on that themselves. They talk about how antis play their part in defining the communities. And there was this one thing I found in Reddit, someone saying if there were no antis and if hybristophilia was more accepted by society, would there be as much of a sense of community in this sub? And then people saying that's a good point. So in some ways, I think that such sense of community as there was is created by pathologization, although it is also to some degree created by circular giving and by shared interpretations of media texts. Obviously, if one is identifying oneself as a serial killer fan, one is interpreting media narratives with at least some degree of sympathy or empathy towards an individual that most people would not feel those towards. So it's this kind of minority view, shared narrative, as well as circular giving and definition by pathologization. But again, I don't think we should overstress the community here because it's in a weak sense at best.
Right. And so you move from that to look at this sort of cultural capital, right, or subcultural capital, as you call it, and kind of how posts and how sort of these fans find a way to get sort of notes or feedback or likes and these kinds of things. So can you talk about that? So there is, though, out there a following of people, and there is some kind of cultural capital in participating in these spaces. So can you talk a little bit
Yeah.
about that in that chapter?
There's some. And I think that probably in terms of the creation of texts, the closest thing I found to big name fans would be certain video makers, certain people who make YouTube videos that were relatively popular and appreciated. So fan vidding, if people don't know, is sort of the editing of images and clips from television or cinema to appropriate music or music that the fan has selected, and editing it in such ways to construct certain narratives. And there were some people who had developed a certain reputation for being very good at this on YouTube. So those were probably the best example of evidence cultural capital in terms of production of a text through many approving comments, through many likes, etc. There were also some, there's also some evidence of this on Tumblr where you can, for example, like and reblog posts. So I analyzed which kinds of posts received the highest number of notes and reblogs, and they tended to be sort of high effort informational posts, high effort aesthetic posts, jokes and humor, which I come back to for the final chapter, and those that demonstrate a fair amount of skill with things like Photoshop and related technologies. But I go on in that chapter to kind of talk then about the collection and display and curation of objects and its relationship to economic capital, which I think is quite a unique, not unique because other fans collect items, but I think the situation of what's referred to as murderabilia is fairly unique.
Yes, I don't know which chapter it was in, but there, you talked about somebody even having, was it some kind of, not necessarily a body part, but right, like having bones or having this, or making sure like they have this authentic piece of like murder fandom in their collection, kind of thing.
Yeah. And I mean, the collection of objects hasn't received a huge amount of attention. Well, it's starting to now, but historically hasn't achieved as much attention in fan studies as the study of text, because I think that, you know, some academics want to shy away from the taint of consumerism, if you like. But there is a kind of thriving industry for the collection and auction and resale of artifacts associated with serial killers, and the real sort and the display and ownership of them is really one of the biggest claims to cultural capital within this sphere, with authenticity and the sanctity of touch being the sort of trump card in there that is kind of goes back to Benjamin and the aura of the object. Like, I look at the website Cult Collectibles, and I did a separate article on the proprietor of Cult Collectibles and Social Capital, where he brokers murderabilia between buyers and sellers, and now has kind of a reputation for that, which he's built up since eBay banned it in the early 2000s. And because he now has this reputation within this sphere and this cultural capital within this sphere, people looking to sell these objects or who have inherited them and don't know what to do with them will actually seek him out, you know. And so he's got many items associated with Jeffrey Dahmer, such as his glasses, other things. He's got, and I gave the example where he's got next to each other an original family photo of Dahmer as a child with his father and a print of that. The original family photo, the bidding opens at $5,000. The print is $15. And they are the same photograph. It's just that one carries the aura of touch and the other doesn't, and they come with sort of certificates of authenticity and so on. So the most striking examples and evidences of subcultural capital were definitely related to objects, touch, and authenticity. And I know that many people kind of, this collection, the collectioning of memorabilia is something that a lot of people find very confronting and objectionable. But the more I thought about it, the more I started to question, well, what's the diff? Where is the line between these objects and some of the objects you'll see in the British Museum, or you know, in any other museum or any other relic of violence? You know, again, if you're gonna start, the site proprietor himself said something which I thought was quite striking, which was that he understands why people would find what he does objectionable, but he doesn't understand the selective objection. Because if you're going to criticize people making money from crime, from violence, that is a valid argument to make. But the guy who made the Ted Bundy tapes has made more in the last 20 minutes than he's going to make in his lifetime. And I thought that was a fair point.
Yep. Yes. And it's okay when you're selling it on Netflix, as you talk about, or on like, but when he's trying to curate, and we do, if we put it in a museum, then it's okay, right? These
Yeah,
kinds of.
exactly. It's very the objections which we kind of feel instinctively when we start to unpack them are very selective.
Yes. And so your last chapter, you talk about this serial killer fandom as sort of digital play, and you say right away in the, chapter that this is, we don't often think about this as play. But can you talk about how you kind of see the digital play playing out, and how you sort of cultivated and curated this chapter?
Yeah, I mean, I read Paul Booth on digital play a few years ago, and I thought that it's very true what he says, that it's a mistake to imagine that fandom and fandom activity, particularly online, is necessarily earnest. Like there's this idea of the earnest internet, which is probably mistaken. You know, I mean, I think that we have to be careful about assuming serious intent. And a lot of this is a kind of play. And on one hand, it's what the fandom I observed is a form of what Booth calls coloring inside the lines. So the lines already drawn by mainstream fascination with serial killers and the endless stream of content, it might be just inside the lines at the edge, but I don't think that it's necessarily beyond them. I think that a lot of this is what. So Booth discusses parody, right? And he focuses on what he calls sociocultural parody. And he introduces this idea of what he calls pornographic parodies of major franchises. So like there's Star Wars porn or porn of Indiana Jones or whatever. And he says that this is parody highlights what is already pornographic about mainstream culture and the undercurrent of sexuality underlying mainstream media texts. And I thought, the more I looked at this, that there's a parallel here, that a lot of the fan texts generated around serial killers are exposing the already extant fascination with serial killing and the media's endless profit from it, and this kind of circular relationship between the consuming public and the media industries. I mean,
Sorry.
yeah, that makes
Wait.
sense. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and you have these examples, which I thought I was trying to find, like the you talk about one example that I, where Dahmer is placed in green next to Kermit the Frog, right? Sort of memes that are created, descriptions of serial killers as people you regret swiping right on dating apps, right? Some of these things that show fans' knowledge of the serial killers and knowledge of this sort of space, but also kind of play with it and, you know, make light of it. So you have to have some knowledge of the serial killers to know, you know, what you're going to regret swiping right on, right? So I think like that's really interesting too, in how that kind of plays out and how they really use what they know and what their interest is to kind of challenge and sort of push at and play with these things.
Yeah, and there was also kind of a lot of what I referred to as nonsense in a slightly technical term, which is to say, like, content that deliberately rebuffs any easy interpretation or meaning is just sort of there in a way that we deliberately don't know how to respond to it. We don't know how to interpret it. And a lot of it is kind of self-consciously humorous, and it's deliberatively provocative. It's deliberately edgy. But I use the term edge because that's why I'm arguing that this is actually operating at the edge of the discourse predefined by the media industry, as opposed to subverting or contradicting it.
So you've written this, right, about sort of killer fandom and serial killer fandom. And do you see any kind of like what's, I don't know if what's next with the serial killer fandom is the best way to phrase it, but I'll phrase it that way anyway, right? Do you see this kind of like, is the celebrity serial killer going to sort of continue? Are you seeing new? Because you talk about people who are all for have like are have already been, you know, are already dead, have already like, you know, did these things. So do you see this as like there are these like, you know, you talk about Dahmer and Warnos and Ramirez and Bundy, but do you see this continuing with sort of newer iterations of serial killer, like where do you see it going?
Well, that's the intro. I mean, there's kind of two aspects to that question. One is like, where do I see work on this going? And one of the good things about this book is that it's open access digital and it's an in iterative form. So anybody can like go on Media Studies Press website and comment on it and tell me what you think, and we'll kind of open a conversation about it. But the interesting, although I have to say it's been quite hard going. And I mean, I had this conversation with the publisher as well. It's been fascinating, but it's been quite hard going at times. And I want to talk about it more, but I'm also slightly depressed now. No, not really. Like, I mean, I want to talk about it more, but it is hard going sometimes. But it's funny because in some ways, the serial killer is, I think it was David Schmidt who said this, a nostalgic figure of domestic and understandable threat in a world in which, you know, threats to humanity's existence of global warming and nuclear war seem, you know, much less comprehensible and bigger and much harder to make news about, and also harder for us to think about. And in some ways, the kind of figure of the serial killer is almost like a nostalgic, domesticable, understandable threat because, you know, there's no kind of contemporary equivalent, is there? I mean, obviously, there's still people who kill people, but I wonder if the serial killer as celebrity is a 20th century phenomenon.
Right, yeah, and in reading your book and in thinking about that, I was wondering, you know, something similar, kind of trying to think of like, would there be something equivalent in 2023, right, to these like the folks that you're talking about who sort of were part of my childhood, right, in that kind of thing. So I thought like it was really interesting to think about, that and where that plays out.
Well, I mean, true crime is going through another resurgence at the moment in terms of media. And a lot of this was kind of brought on by the massive success of the podcast Serial. And that, incidentally, is a text that makes me question my own consumption of true crime media, in the sense that it's about a person whose family is very much alive and aware of what is going on, and the fact that there is now this juggernaut media property based around the murder of their sister and daughter, and a perspective on whether or not the accused is guilty, you know. And that really kind of, when I started to think more reflectively about my true crime consumption, that sort of brought me up short a little bit. So it seems that, I mean, true crime media isn't going anywhere. It's getting bigger, if anything. It's going through a resurgence, although it's always popular, it just waxes and wanes. But it's almost that it's like a nostalgic genre now. And the fandom is almost a nostalgic genre. I mean, most of the serial killers in this sample were dead before the people making this content were born.
Right.
So I guess the question is, why is that? I mean,
I know. Yes, I find it really interesting, right, to think about, and to think about that there continues to be this sort of interest in these people who have long been dead.
yeah. Well, why do we still have, new Netflix film about them every
Right.
week, you know?
Yes. Yes, exactly, right? And we sort of continue this consumption. So, yeah, it's interesting to think about and how this plays out. So, I mean, we've been talking a while, but so I'll ask you my kind of final question, and which is there things you're working on? I mean, either with this book or something new, like what are you working on? What's next? Self, promote. Go.
So, what I'm working on right now is, I mean, as I say, this book was in gestation for a few years, and it's been, in some ways, it's been a fascinating journey, and I'm so grateful to have done it. But in some ways, I might need to like let it breathe a little bit now. And I have, I have other interests in fandom, particularly around music and musicianship and so on. And also, I'm doing a lot of work with the Open Book Collective. This book was published through Media Studies Press, which is one of the presses that is part of our collective, making books open access without the necessity of book processing charges, which is very important work. Nonetheless, I am wanting to set up a network, and I'm applying for some funding. I don't know if I'll get it yet, but I'm applying for a small grant to set up a network for fan scholars who are interested in fandom related to true crime and criminals. I'm taking the word dark out of there before it becomes enmeshed, and kind of seeing what, this is an embryonic subfield. There's been a little bit of work on mass shooters and so on, and what's the direction from here, opening a new research pathway. I mean, my particular interest, as you've gathered, is on how and why certain forms of production and consumption around true crime are culturally and economically legitimate and even respectable, and some forms are very much not. And why does that happen, and how does it happen, and why does everything that girls do get pathologized?
Well, it has been super interesting talking with you. It's been really fascinating. Judith May Fatala, who is the author of Killer Fandom, Fan Studies, and The Celebrity Serial Killer. Thank you so much for talking with me for New Books and Popular Culture.
Thank you so much for having me.